Hello and welcome to another edition of the In Context podcast. I'm back again with my good friend Stephen Neil and I'm Ian Williamson, and we are both from Medhurst Ministries. Even though Stephen isn't yet employed, he's still a trustee and a pastor who's part of the Pastors Network. So how are you doing, brother? Are you well?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you, mate. Doing well.
Good. We're just doing a series at the moment, and this series is called What is Working Class? I have written an article a few years ago that featured in Mes McConnell's book. Can't even remember the name of the book, can you? That big, fat, massive book, doorstop.
Least Last and Lost.
At least the last and the lost, that's it. Yeah, I use it for standing on when I'm changing light bulbs. It's that thick. So the article expressed and explored what it was like for me to be working class growing up as a young boy, as a teenager, and as an adult. But one of the things that concerns me is out of ease, when I speak about working class, I don't just mean the working class. I'm encouraging those who aren't working. I'm talking about those who may be homeless, those who, basically anyone who's not middle or upper class. So it's like a blanket term, and the term working class was quite specific back when I was growing up. You were just working class. Everyone was working class. There was very few people on the dole. Everyone had a job. Those who were working class would generally live on a council estate and would be employed. Some people had good jobs where they were paid well, but it was usually hard jobs, even if it was paid well. But things have changed over the last couple of generations. Especially the generations that I've seen from being a boy in the 70s through to now in the 2020s. And there's a lot of confusion on who is and who isn't working class and what makes a person working class. So today, Steve, I'd like you to explain, because me and you have a lot of similarities, I think, as in our life experience. There's only 10 years difference between us, so our experience of what working class is will be quite similar, but quite different as well. You were churched, you were brought up in a church, you were working class, but part of a working class Christian family, so that brings some differences. But also I went down the route of addiction and drugs and criminality, so there's some differences then. But generally I would say our experience and an early family life at least was very similar. So could you just share a little bit about what working class means to you and what it was like for you, first of all, as a child?
Yeah, I mean, I hear this a lot. I mean, I'm muddled anyway, because I'm not from one place. So I was sort of born in Oxford to, you know, a father from inner city Liverpool and a mother from inner city Bristol. Then when I was very young, moved to Birkenhead, which is a post-industrial northern town, and then back down to Oxfordshire to a rural middle-class village. So I've been in those places, and then eventually went to university in Liverpool again. So I was sort of up and down the M6 between Oxfordshire and Merseyside most of my life, you know, up to about the age of 21. So that, and that's means that regionally, I don't have much of a regional sort of strong identity. I'd say mainly I'm from the area in Oxfordshire. It's a little town. I was actually from a village called Grove, but it's attached to a town called Wantage that people have equally not heard of. And so I'd say that's where I'm really from. But that's a very middle class town, and the church we went to was about half an hour away in a even posher town called Abingdon, or Abingdon upon Thames, as it officially called, in a very middle class Baptist church where there weren't many working class people in that church at all. And so I've always sort of moved in middle class circles. I went to a comprehensive school in Berkshire that drew in people from three counties. So it had people from council estates, people from very well-to-do families and everyone in between. So you saw everybody there. And so I mixed with a fairly wide range of people. So I've always kind of had, you know, a muddled identity, if you like, that way. I think when people talk about being working class, they'll often jump to the markers. So I, you know, I've had people say, "Oh, you're not working class because you mainly grew up in Grove, you know, in Oxfordshire," as if there are no people who lay bricks, or there are no people who, you know, fix boilers who lived in the village, you know, when they did. And you know, my mother, of the two of them, my mum came from a slightly better off family than my dad's. So my mum's family were probably lower middle class, really. But my mum left school at 16 with no qualifications, had some very hard things happen to her in her childhood as well that were, I think, affected her in various ways. So she kind of, and then marries my dad, who's from a very, very working class in a city, Liverpool family, who also left school at 16 and did what people in Liverpool do and joined the Navy, you know. And then he came out when he met me mum. So in many ways, my mum assimilated from a lower middle class family to a more working class one, which was then how we were raised. But then we had the church, and the church was a very middle class influence on us, and we lived in a middle class town, sorry, middle class village rather. So that was an influence on us. So all of that makes a difference to how you experience things. I didn't grow up on a council estate, but equally, I've never lived in a house other than the one I'm in right now that was owned by anyone who lived there. My parents did very ordinary jobs. My mum was a carer, and my dad was a heating engineer. That they again didn't go to university or anything like that. It wasn't till I was 16, my mum worked her way up from the laundry to caring to seniors in senior carer to eventually managing the home. But the first time she was managing the home, I was sort of 16, 17 and about to leave home, you know. So the first middle class job my mum had, I was almost out the house at that point. And my dad, same, he started working for a Christian organization when I was about 16. And again, that was the first sort of middle class office job that he had that, again, was happening pretty well on my way out the door. Do you know what I mean? And my mum and dad's values in the house didn't suddenly disappear. Do you know what I mean? It didn't like change as soon as we just had a little bit more money than we had before. I can't even remember what your question was now.
Yeah, was that long ago? No, no, I was just wanting to share your experience of what it meant to be working class, and it was interesting you mentioned like markers. So before we get back to that, just sh share a little bit more about the markers, because when you were talking about markers, cultural markers or whatever defines you as working class or middle class, what the markers you were using seem to be around education and employment and accommodation, which were more like practical things. Is that right? Would that be the markers you were looking at?
I think that's what some people would think of. The reason I land on those things is because that's what people commonly think, and I don't think markers are always very helpful. So I had somebody say, for example, so I have been to university, got several degrees now, and I had someone go, "Well, that makes you middle class then because of your education," which I just think is deeply offensive because you're basically saying all working class people must be thick then, because as soon as you go to university, if you work hard and you're bright and you go to university, you stop being middle class, sorry, start being middle class. And as soon as, if you don't, then you're working class. So the only people who are working class must be thick, you know. And I just think that cannot possibly be true or right. And then you get other markers like the jobs that people do. So I had one person tell me once, you know, "Well, if you work in an office, then you're middle class." At which point you're like, "Well, I know a lot of receptionists, and I don't think they're necessarily middle class, and I know a lot of people who work in call centres in an office, and I'm pretty sure they're not middle class either." So I think the markers thing can is often a red herring, and it doesn't help you very much. And the only reason I land on it is to go, if you want to say I'm middle class, the only marker, traditional marker, you've really got is that I've got education. I went to university. Now, if that makes me middle class, fine. But I just don't think it does. I know lots of people who went to university who aren't from that background. I think sociologists don't talk in terms of markers. They talk in terms of capital and what you might spend. So there's a sociologist called Pierre Bourdieu. He talks about your cultural capital, your social capital, and your economic capital. In simple terms, that's money, and what your money you can spend. It's your sort of cultural worldview, the things that you would that would mark you out as having sort of certain cultural knowledge. It might be the language you use, it might be the places you go, it might be the things that you talk about, that sort of thing. And then there's your social capital, which is your networks and the people you know. So they're kind of the things you can spend different bits of capital to get you different things. And I think that's a more helpful way of thinking about it. So if you think of my childhood, I was on free school meals at various points, which is normally a pretty basic marker of poverty. So I've had points in my childhood my family would have been considered poor and deprived, even though for most of my childhood that wasn't the case. I would say some of it was. Most of it, though, we didn't have money. We were not wealthy. I'd say we had low economic capital. In terms of cultural capital, we didn't speak the same way as the people in my area, even to the middle class people around us or the middle class people in church. We didn't speak like them, we didn't think like them, we didn't act like them, we didn't dress like them. Just on all those markers, we didn't go to the, we weren't a family that went around art galleries, and that sort of thing. I'd never even heard of the National Trust until I married my wife. Didn't even know what it was. But those are sort of like common places and things that middle class people would do that it just wasn't within my frame of reference at all. And then you've got social capital. Now that's one where traditionally a lot of working class people wouldn't necessarily score very high. My family did score would score quite high in social capital, and the reason is because of the church. So we didn't have much money and we didn't have the same cultural worldview, but I did have a social network that suddenly, even on the church in the council estate in Birkenhead that we went to, one of the elders there was a local judge. Now, the only time I knew working class people meeting a judge was when they were in court, but there was a guy who was our friend who was a judge,
Or if he owned the house you were renting, so
That's right.
that.
But there was that, so you go. I met him on a council estate, and it's because of the church. And in the church we grew up in, there were accountants, there were people working in the NHS, there were people doing all sorts of things. And you go in, I'd have never met these people or had anything to do with them, but because we're in the church together, you do, and that opens up a whole network of people that can be helpful to you. So I would say, if you think of deprivation in terms of being scoring low on all of those things, and then you think of class as being effectively a sliding scale of those things. My family would qualify as working class, but because of the church, had a reasonable social network. That's how I would describe it.
Yeah, I find it interesting. Who was that dude you quoted?
Pierre Bourdieu. Yeah.
Audio, yeah. I can't pronounce his surname, but
Makes me sound posh, though, to say it, doesn't
well, no, I actually know what you're talking about because I cited him in my dissertation. So I'm equally posh and middle class as you were, brother. So.
Where do you think I heard about him, Ian?
But again, I just found it interesting how sociologists and many people, when they're looking at cultural markers, will look at the practical rather than what I would deem the cultural and emotional. And so for me, looking at working class markers, I look at more sense of humour. They've got a dark humour, loyalty, behaviours more than. Behaviors and attitudes rather than practical, financial, or during my research, I identified a lot of cultural and emotional markers that would fit in with me, you and Gary, Mez, all the working class pastors that I know
Could you
are
give some
very
examples of them?
probably having a dark sense of humor, loyalty, strong family connections. I think it was probably based more about identity, wearing your heart on your sleeve. The markers that were identified, this was when we interviewed working class church members. They spoke about having a relational community. So even those who lived in one parent families or were single parents themselves said that even with the breakdown in family and with national migration, with people going working elsewhere or going to study elsewhere, like social uplift on a council estate, although the family's not as tight as it used to be, the local community still is. So there was a relational community was seen as a marker of working classness, honesty and openness, which kind of stems from that relational community. A lot of people valued that characteristic amongst themselves. They said that they were emotional and passionate, and that they could be perceived as confrontational or aggressive when they were just being passionate or trying to get the point across. If somebody says, "How's your day been?" and you say, "Oh crap, I've had enough. I feel like packing my job in," that would be seen as kind of emotionally unstable by a middle class person. Whereas the working class person isn't actually going to hand his notice in the next day or pack his job in. They're just like describing how they feel emotionally, whereas some people would see that as emotional instability. Being fighters and survivors as well. A lot of people said that their lives had been tough and they spoke fondly of battling through struggles, trauma, and pain. Dark humor and banter was another one, and said that often, like insulting people. There was a level of insults. One was a sign of affection, that would be the banter. Then obviously there would be insults which were meant to be insults, and that they were natural storytellers. And another one, which I think everyone highlighted of experiencing within the church as much as within society, was feeling excluded and alienated. So I wonder if you can relate with any of them, and if any of those markers would better describe you as working class or as would there be a better marker than the ones that Imu Boudoir fella?
I think they describe characteristics better. I think that's, I don't. They're not cast iron, though, are they? So I
No.
think there are, obviously personality elements and other things like that that all impact on those things. So they're not necessarily true of everyone, but I'd say as a generally true of me and my family. I think there's another thing that goes on, so which is probably different between you and I, because you weren't brought up in the church, but I was. And what that meant was I became an expert in code switching. And because I had middle class and working class mates at school, and because I've been in the church, you learn in these groups you operate like this and you talk like this, and in these groups you operate like that and talk like that. Do you know what I mean? And there was, you just sort of get used to it, where you talk in a more measured and careful way, when you're talking with people at church. And you talk in a more sort of open and effusive way when I'm talking with my family at home. It's that, and I just remember living sort of betwixt and between all the time. Do you know what I mean? Where you're operating, you'd literally go out of one conversation with one person talking one way and talking an entirely different way with this other person, and you just sort of did it. And it's almost like in your head you're going, "Oh, it's contextual." But I always found that very wearing and very difficult. And I wouldn't have even realized I was doing it, to be honest, at the time. I wouldn't have called it code switching. Then I never even heard of that term. I've just learned later that's what it was that I was doing. And again, I think that makes it difficult for me when you read out those sort of markers. I'd go, broadly speaking, that describes how we are in my family. But in reality, actually, I was constantly switching out of that mode of operation and operating in a different way to try and fit in with like a church culture or a school culture or a work culture. So, you know what I mean? That, and that's really tiring to do that all the time.
So again, I think like within the emotional the emotional level, the markers and the relational markers, the community and relationships marker, was like affection was a big thing. So banter and humor was seen as affectionate, but also physical affection from the men, which I find quite strange. So I think I wonder if more Pentecostal council estate churches, a lot of people hug within the church, and then when you get to more middle class conservative churches, it's more of a stiff handshake, and hugging and physical signs of affection. I see less in the middle class church, and it's weird. Whereas I belong to a gym, an MMA gym. Some real tough lads, lots of different ethnicities, religions, a lot of atheists. These some guys involved in past criminal lives, others still working as nightclub bouncers and stuff like that. What a lot of people, if you saw them and the behaviour, would be described as toxic masculinity. Yet when you see them, man, it's handshake, big hug, and like these are tough men showing the physical affection to one another, where probably. Some people might see them as toxic masculinity, homophobic, sexist, misogynist, just the way they use the language. But some of the most kind, gentle, loving men, great fathers, love the husbands, protectors. And but again, just the image you would get from looking at them and hearing their language, people would be offended. Yet they're some of the most gentle, kind, and loving people that you could ever meet. And again, I think within those markers, as you look deeper, I think language is another huge marker as well, whether it be how honest and open you are, or to the words you use and what appears to be offensive or not. How did that journey happen for you, and how has that affected you, as you said, like navigate between the two?
I mean, that's the thing I've struggled with all my life because, like I say, I'm what am I now? Third generation Christian. My son is a fourth generation Christian, right?
Praise God, eh?
And look, that what there's nothing bad to be said about that at all, is there? And no, there's I'm just so grateful that my grandfather was saved, because that means that, you know, not everyone in my dad's family is saved, not everyone in my mum's family is saved, but praise God that my branch of the family is. But stuff like you see, and this is the impact of a middle class traditional church upbringing will put on you as well, because my dad was brought up in the Brethren in Liverpool, and the Brethren are they're very, very good at going to council estates, actually, compared to an awful lot of churches. I don't know many churches other than them that go to those sorts of places, and they do it purposefully. But they're also incredibly traditional. So you'll go on a council estate and have all these guys wearing suits and all the women in hats, you know, and all of this sort of stuff, and Sunday best and all of that type of thing. And that's just a bit of how I just felt schizophrenic growing up all the time. And when I was young, you know, it was, as I say, you'd go to church and be one way and come home and be another way. You'd be a bit freer in your language at home in a way that you wouldn't in church. And I for most of my childhood would have just seen that as a Christian thing, you know. And my dad, he'd like take physical affection. Like, my dad's family are not even, they're working class, but they're not effusive in that way at all, because I think the church, you know, I mean, you just didn't, partly the church, I'd say partly the church, partly obviously my grandfather was from the silent generation in the ward, you know what I mean? He wasn't, you just didn't do that in that generation, you know. So some of it's generational and come down, and some of it I think it's the church. So stiff, starchy church, again driven by a middle class culture. So they went to church in a poor part of Liverpool, but the church culture was dominated by a middle class culture because that's what all churches did at the time. And so you go and you just go, well, that's what Christians do. And then that's kind of fed into my family a bit. So it's always really difficult picking apart what's my family's natural tendency and what's the church's influence on my family and what are the bits of the church's influence on my family that are good and my family probably should never have been doing in the first place, but we did. And what are the influences of the church on my family that are actually ruining, good things that my family did, but because they're trying to make us middle class. And I still don't know the answer to that. It's so complicated to unpick all of that. I think all I really came to the conclusion was there were certain people I was careful how I spoke around. Was careful what I said. And occasionally you realized it mid-sentence when you just said something and you'd realize like, oh yeah, I wasn't meant to say that type of thing.
Again, I think that's been similar for me, and like sometimes my kids are like, "Dad, you can't say that." Dad, please don't say that. When I say kids, the adults now, but yeah, I think for me, I used to pride myself on, like, I'm not going to change the way I speak to fit in. And it almost became a stubbornness. And, like, I think I almost deliberately offended people to protect my culture. Whereas now, what I'm trying to do is say, well, do you know what? If someone finds that offensive, so it's a bit. I think you mentioned about your dad not being hypocritical in the previous podcast. We spoke about how your dad was different at church to how he was at home, but it wasn't hypocritical. He was just navigating cultures. So I think what I do now is I probably navigate cultures now, not because I have to, but because I don't want to unnecessarily offend people. So I might speak more refined in public than I used to. Which is hilarious because everyone still thinks I'm rough as boots and offensive now. So when people are offended by anything I've said, I think if only you knew what goes on in my head, then you would be offended. And I find that hard, that when I'm actually making an effort not to offend, people are still offended. I wonder if you've ever had that issue.
Very much, yeah. regularly. And with my dad's a good case example on this as well, do you know? Because my dad is, I mean, he can't help himself. He says things all the time. And even I sit there sometimes and I'm like, ah, dad, don't do that to yourself. But he can't, it just comes out. But the thing with him is he because he's a second generation Christian, some of it he assimilates and he knows he's assimilating. Some of it he assimilates, and again it's because that's Christian, and so a lot of my dad's forms of Christianity would be very traditional. He would have a very sort of traditional view of church. Now, if he's not a stupid man and he's thought theologically and he's a godly man, so if you push him sometimes on it and you go, but why that? Where does the Bible say that? Or where does the Bible make that the only legitimate form? He will go, yeah, I'm not sure. I just feel really uncomfortable with it, And often that's because he's been brought up in a culture that said that's what Christians do, and he's just gone on with it. Do you know what I mean? And so some of it pushes against his natural culture, but because he's gone along with it, and he's gone along with it since he was born, because he was raised in the church like I was, it's really hard to pick apart. Do you know what I mean? Which bits are, do I actually believe are Christian myself, and which bits of it have I just assimilated to because I just needed to get on? And so with me, I mean, when I first started, I preached my first sermon ever in the church when I was 17. So I'd done open air preaching before that, like short talks and stuff, gospel talks and things, which is great training actually. I think it's brilliant training for anybody doing that. But I preached the first time in church when I was 17, and I preached in a shirt and tie because now I'd never gone to church in a shirt and tie. People knew who I was. I mean, I used to dress like I was down the skate park. That's what I looked like. Still how I dress now. I look like an extra from Tony Hawk. Do you know what I mean? And I was told pretty clearly, I think by my dad, but I mean the impression I got from others was you need to wear a shirt and tie to go in the pulpit. And they'd asked me, and they knew I never wore that, and I'd never been seen wearing that, and that's not what I would have done in church, but there was this sense and expectation that's what you do. And there were elements of that when I first started preaching where I'd wear a shirt and tie just because that's what people expected of you. Do you know what I mean? So that would be an example of where I just assimilated. In terms of my language, I think I tried to assimilate a bit because I just, you don't want to go around offending everybody all the time, do you? So I think that you sort of adjust yourself around people, but also you realize you catch yourself at times as well, slipping into your natural mode of operation, if you know what I mean. And you say stuff you shouldn't. So I mean, like I say, I don't even know which bits I've just assimilated and taken on and which bits that I haven't. I mean, I don't preach in a shirt and tie anymore, and I haven't done for a long time, but that was since I became a pastor. Do you know what I mean? And I went, well, I don't have to. Do you know what I mean? I can do what I want. And actually doing it's amazing the difference it makes. People think it doesn't matter or think you're trying to make a point or something like that, and it's not. I wear what I wear because it's what I would wear. But we had a lady from a single mum from a council estate join our church, and she told me one time, she said, I was really, really worried about coming to church the first time, and I was really struggling with the thought of being there looking, because she said, this is me quoting her now, she said, because I dress like a right chav, she said. And so I was really worried about it. I was like, all right. And then she went, yeah, but then I saw you and I felt all right. And same woman said, I used to go around people's houses when I first became a Christian. I bought myself a load of pots to put on the table so that when anyone came, I could serve them food because I thought that was what was biblical and I thought that was Christian. And she said, it took me ages before I realized, oh no, it's just because it's middle class people doing it. Because I said, who does it? And she went, well, that person, that person, that person. I went, right. And do you reckon they're working class? Like, no. I was like, why do you think they do that? Oh, it's like a middle class thing. I was like, yeah.
Well, that was another marker that you mentioned there about clothing, and the, so when I was interviewing congregations about dress, shirt and tie, and I spoke with middle class and working class members of the congregation, and they both thought that clothing was equally important. Important as it symbolized it, as it symbolized trust. But it's interesting to see how the middle class saw the shirt and tie and the suit as someone that they could trust because it represented an authority that they felt safe and comfortable with, and how the shirt and tie produced distrust in many of the working class people for the same reasons because it represented authority. But for the working class, that authority was oppressive. It reminded them as abusive of abusive school teachers, the police, or social workers that they'd had negative interactions with, and how someone dressed, I don't know, whether it be in a tracksuit, a pair of jeans, and a t-shirt, was more trustworthy for the working class because it was somebody being themselves and not trying to pretend there was somebody else. Yeah, so the symbolism of the clothes was hugely important that I saw across both classes, but it meant different things to different people.
Yeah, and I think that's something that people don't understand is however you dress, actually you communicate something. So I know there are working class people who see how I dress and they feel comfortable because they're like, that's how I dress. This is a place for people like me. I also know there are Africans who would come in and see how I dress and think, who's this moron? Can't take this guy seriously. He looks like a pillock. And then I know there are middle class people who would see me, and some of them would be intimidated and go, the only people I know who dress like this are like thugs on street corners and stuff like that, and I'm scared of them. So but at the same time, as you say, there's this default assumption that if you wear a suit, oh, everyone gets on well with that, and it just isn't true. Sometimes where they've got a point is that clothes always communicate something to people. They always do. But you can't make the assumption that what you think they communicate is what it's communicating to everybody else. I think that's the problem, which is why authenticity is important. So I don't mind if a guy who always wears a suit everywhere he goes, like my granddad always wore a suit everywhere he went. He was a painter and decorator, and he'd paint and decorate in a suit, like, 'cause that's what he did back then. Do you know what I mean? Now, if that's you and that's the kind of person you are, then fight preaching that, because that's you, isn't it? And if you're the kind of person like me who wears trackies and joggers and baggy jeans or whatever, preaching that because that's you. And I think that's what's important, is authenticity and people seeing that you're the same bloke in the pulpit, that you're out of it. Because when they get to know you, they'll go, that's what he's like, that's why he dresses that way. I think some people hear you talk about clothing. Could I've had a middle class guy say this to me, but if I dressed like you, I'd look like a prat, and people would just think, this guy's like, full of BS. Do you know what I mean? Because he's dressing like an idiot, trying to be cool, and he's not. And I agree. I think that would be awful. But I said, where you get the problem is you need to be yourself, and I need to be myself, and we need to be authentic. I think that's right. But if your church is dominated by people who've been told you've got to dress this way or look this way to get on, and everyone in the pulpit only ever has a shirt and tie on, or even if everyone in the pulpit only ever looked like me, do you know what I mean? If you're not like me, you end up sitting there going, oh, well, I'm never going to get in the pulpit then, am I? Which is why you get people like me who end up wearing shirt and tie in order to go into the pulpit, when the only place I wear shirt and tie is at a funeral. Do you know what I mean? That's it.
Again, you mentioned education, and we've looked at language, and that presumption that if you're educated, you've moved from the working classes up to the middle classes, and vice versa, and also, like, the language that you use. So I've got two questions based on that. So first of all, just to kind of debunk that, if you look at someone like Eminem, who was seen as white trash, white working class, living in a trailer, mum was an addict, single parents, he was involved on the streets, with some unsavory stuff. He was a rapper. He read spent time reading dictionaries. He educated himself. He was a one of the best wordsmiths I've heard. He's well renowned across the rap scene. He's respected by everyone, even though he's one of the few good white rappers. And but the language is he uses that knowledge he's got, he's still retained his authentic white working class roots, hasn't he? So his education has propelled him to continue within his culture. And I wonder, within the church, you've become educated as you were preaching before you were 17, but then you ended up in obviously university doing degrees and postgraduate studies. So, how have you seen your education affect your working classness? Has that removed any missionary power and cultural power from you? Have you adapted because that's something you've chose to do, or have you felt forced to, or has there been no change?
I don't think it's changed me that much, to be honest. The only thing having a master's has done for me is made a whole load of people who would have dismissed everything I said listen to me a bit more. That's it. I had people say to me, oh, your education must have been brilliant for you because you write a blog and that's what's made you good at that. I was like, well, I was blogging before I had those things. And I was writing things before I had those things. I mean, so writing is just something that I have naturally done. Do you know what I mean? I remember, not this is a big deal, but I remember writing a play as a kid in primary school and winning a prize for it. Do you know what I mean? And doing the same at secondary school with a mate. Do you know what I mean? So writing is something I've always done and been just naturally okay at doing. So the idea that my academic qualifications have made me a good writer, I don't think is true. I think writing has made me a good writer, just writing. I don't think my preaching has been helped at all, like at all, by any of my education. I think if anything, it will have been detrimental. And I've worked very hard when I stand in the pulpit to try and talk like I'd normally talk. And even then, I sometimes slide into stuff because I've read a load of commentaries that speak in academic language. I have to work hard not to just do that. Partly because that's a shortcut, isn't it? Just taking the commentary and going, oh, I'll just say that. No, I have to work hard to go, actually, that's not how I would speak or say any of that stuff. So I don't think it's helped me in that regard, but I don't think I've changed that much, really. But then I wasn't a very good student, so that's probably not going to help either. I did the bare minimum to do as well as I could, I think it was the answer. And you sometimes misjudge that, don't you? So, but I learned how to do it. I learned the form of it, of writing essays and things like that. I learned what they were aiming for, and then didn't really go to many lectures and didn't actually read that many books. I just learned how to do it and then did quite well because I'd learned the form that they wanted. I mean, so I'm not sure it actually accomplished a lot other than it gives me a couple of letters after my name where I can turn around and go, you've got to listen to me now because I have letters that make you think I'm important, even though I was saying all the same things before. So I don't know. I'm not, and maybe this is my working class route coming out, because I mean, education wasn't pushed in my house at all. We didn't have books in the house, really. I think I remember one bookshelf of anything. And then in my dad's office, again, because he's a Christian and because he was preaching, he had a shelf with some commentaries and things on it, which I never touched because I wasn't doing that kind of work. But we had like very few books in the house. Reading, no, my parents weren't anti it. They weren't like, don't learn, don't do stuff. But they weren't, it wasn't a big deal. And I guess I don't feel that now either. I just think education can be helpful, can be good, can be positive, but I don't think it's the be all and end all. Do you know what I mean? I think you can be bright without going to university and you can do well. And actually, I think what happens to a lot of people, particularly humanities, which is what I did. I think people don't come out able to think better or knowing more about stuff. I think very often they come out being able to make arguments for the bad views that they already held before they went in. That's what a lot of education does for you.
Yeah, it's interesting what you were saying about books there, but for me, my life was full of books as a child, and just remember my grand, probably because we couldn't afford a telly, but I remember like my granddad, well, everyone, we all read all of it, like nana's, granddad's, aunties, uncles. There was always a good book. I remember my granddad giving me a Last of the Mohicans book when I was about 8 and saying, read that, it's a really good book. And yeah, and then we had a book club coming in at school, and you could buy a book every, I don't know if it was every month or every week. And I'd always go to bed reading with a torch under my duvet. I was fascinated with books. And then when I worked offshore, I'd do 12-hour night shifts, so that helped pass the night shift by sitting and reading. And again, I think similarly, education hasn't really, but I do think it's helped me. I was always frightened of education. I always thought doing a degree or a master's or something, you needed to be like a super boffin, and it was beyond me. And I think what it's done is remind me, like, I should have just done this years ago. It was like, for some reason, I think that's what can happen in some working class communities. Some people can think that is for me, that's for like boffins. And then when I did it, and then some of the students who were like asking me my advice, I was like, flipping heck, they haven't got a clue. And I felt self-conscious going in to education, and felt that I wasn't didn't have the ability to study. And then I thought, wow, it's just that I've never done it. That was like, that formula was the hardest thing for me. Learning, I had the knowledge, but how do I write it down so that people find it acceptable? And I think that was the most difficult thing. Plus also the probably self-doubt and never having really the encouragement at school to do well. I think the problem for me was I was constantly told like to shut up, stop messing on, stop. No one actually come alongside and encourage. I spent more time outside the headmaster's office than I did actually sat at the desk in front of the teacher. So I'm not saying that my behaviour didn't have anything to play at it, but there was very little encouragement from our school to progress. Basically, when the careers advisor came around, the boys were told, go to TTE and go and work in the British Steel. And the girls were told to learn how to cut hair, basically, at our school. There was no encouragement to go on to further education.
Yeah, so I think in ours, my school's weird in the sense that because it was in a middle class area, there were a lot of middle class kids who would have expected to go on to university. So I kind of moved in circles where for there were plenty of people around me and in my church, you know, it's sort of expected people would go to university. So I, you know, the thought of going to university wasn't that weird to me, but my parents didn't particularly push it. You know what I mean? Or say they wouldn't have cared if I'd gone or not, and they wouldn't have been worried by it, and they didn't push me to do it. So when I didn't revise for stuff or I didn't put in any effort in exams or whatever, I had mates whose parents were all over them. Do you know what I mean? To study, my parents were just like, "Well, if you fail, don't you?" That was their line on it, and it wasn't like this is vital for your life chances. It was just like, "Well, you'll find out, won't you, when you." And it just so happened. I mean, I still think I am incredibly lazy, to be honest. I'm not a hard worker, really. I just learned what the minimum I needed to do to look credible was. Basically, I managed because I was reasonably bright, I suppose. I managed to coast all the way through school and do okay. I wouldn't set the world alight by any means. Like, I think if I put in some effort, I could have done a lot better. But I did fine. You know, I did well enough to go on to sixth form. I did well enough to go to a red brick university, you know, one of the Russell Group universities. I didn't really put in that much effort. And then at university, I didn't do a great deal, to be honest with you. And I did well enough, do you know what I mean, to get the kind of things that you might want to go on to or do. I think it's because it wasn't pushed. Do you know what I mean? It was, and I think unless I really see the value of something or really see the purpose behind something or I've got a real sense of it being morally right or important for me to do, I struggle to push myself, do you know what I mean, to do the effort, but I managed to do okay.
Was university free when you did it?
No, but
No, no.
it was like, well, I mean, so it sort of was in the sense that a student loan didn't feel like it counted. Do you know what I mean? It was free money as I judged it. And again, I think working class mindset comes in a bit because you get this grant that you pay back eventually, but I was like, well, I don't pay it back until I earn, so it doesn't matter. And then I went on and did a teacher training qualification straight afterwards. I'd finished my degree and didn't know what to do, so I fell into teaching. I'd done a history degree and I planned to be a history teacher, got rejected from it, and then I didn't know they chuck your application into all the shortage subjects if you fail. And so it got chucked in. So I ended up going on like an RE teacher's course instead. I was like, all right, I'll do that then. I trained that and they give you a grant for that. I just remember my dad going, I was like, oh, yeah, I've got this grant that'll pay me fees and pay all of this. It's like, can you get a student loan? I was like, yeah. He's like, well, you should get that as well then, you know, just so I did. So yeah, I didn't really treat it as, do you know what I mean? It was like free money as far as I was concerned, and you just got it and did it and lived off it, and then you worry about it when you're paying back a job. Do you know what I mean? I didn't really think that far ahead. I don't know what the point of any of this conversation is, really. Different applied to that, I'm really lazy.
So what about relationships then? So you've mentioned that you straddle two cultures at home and at church. Then you go to uni, so obviously not exclusively middle class, but I'll imagine it was still probably dominated by the working class. If you look at today's figures, there'll have been some working class people there, but predominantly middle class people, I'd imagine. And then, like, as a pastor working with in a working class community, and you've also got working class pastors you're working with, and because the working class is so broad in terms, how have you had that? Have you had people calling you middle class who are working class and kind of saying you aren't one of us. Look at you with your big posh words and your red brick university. And then have you had people who are middle class looking down at you saying you aren't one of us? You've only been to a Russell Group university. To be one of us, you've got to be at Oxford and Cambridge. How have you found like to say you can navigate across cultures might be one thing, but how does that feel to have to navigate?
Yeah, the thing is, you say you can navigate, which is, I kind of know some of the markers, some of the rules, some of the things to navigate. But in reality, yeah, you're not really accepted by anyone, are you? It's kind of, I don't want to make a like for like comparison, but it's like mixed race people will talk about it. Do you know what I mean? They'll go like, I'm white mother, black father, something like that. You'd think therefore you'd be accepted by both sides, and actually it turns out that no one wants you, sort of thing. And it feels a bit like that sometimes, where yeah, you go, what I find is I get called middle class by people who want to. If I'm talking about the issues of class in the church, people will very quickly try and shut it down and call me middle class. But then the irony is, when you go, okay, then fine, I'm middle class then, I'm one of you then, aren't I? And they go, no, well, not really. Like, well, okay, you can't have it both ways. Do you know what I mean? And if you try and represent working class people, again, and I can understand this a bit more, but it can be an element of, yeah, but you're not really representing us, because you're not, you went to university and we didn't, or you didn't live on a council estate most of your life, whereas we did, things like that. And you go in, well, okay. And the fact is, I am what I am. So, I mean, if someone wants to call me middle class, it doesn't worry me. If someone wants to call me working class, it doesn't worry me. I don't really care. I don't think it makes any great difference to the points I'm making. Could I just go, okay, fine, whatever I am, we can put to one side, it doesn't really matter. Question is what I'm saying true? That's where I try and focus those sorts of conversations. I just think, yeah, there are people who would tend to push you in a different direction. It depends on what their particular issue is. Do you know what I mean? I just think my view of middle class people generally is they're very brittle. Do you know what I mean? They are incredibly brittle, and they seem to take almost everything as a personal offence and a personal dig at them. And I think that's why it's very hard to ever have useful conversations about class, because if you talk about class, the first thing that they'll do is become very defensive. And so in my case, they'll start arguing on middle class as if that rejects it, and when I basically go, okay, fine, I'll be middle class then, and then they go, oh no, you're not though. Okay, well, what am I then? And even aside from me, is this stuff true? And then they just, when you can see people dancing around just trying to find the thing that means I don't have to listen. I think that's the thing that I find very difficult about the conversation. I don't really care what people view me as. I don't really care if they think I'm working class or middle class. It just doesn't matter, really. I think class ultimately is a unbiblical, anti-gospel concept anyway. I think it's useful as a descriptor of, these people are broadly like this and these people are broadly like that. I think it can be useful as far as that goes. But I think fundamentally, class is a construct, isn't it, that British people in particular are obsessed with, that our society is riddled with, that people use to beat people with. And I just think it's anti-gospel, and I wish we could all just go, okay, fine, it doesn't matter. But then why are we talking? How do we describe this group of people over here who you aren't in your church, and what is the reason for that?
How do you think, let me phrase this question right. Yeah, why do you think middle class people, or do you think even that middle class people are content with the British class structure and almost proud of it, yet are appalled by the caste system, say in India? When it's for me missiologically, it's almost identical.
I feel sorry for middle class people, really, because they wish they were upper class and they're not. That's what drives them. They wish they were upper class and they're not. They want to be like that. And then they do with the upper classes exactly what a lot of working class people do with the middle classes, which is, oh, fine then, I don't fit in with your super posh, old money ways, then, we'll do our own thing. And then they go and do exactly the same thing to working class people, I think. So I don't know it's that they're proud of it. I think they're just brittle. I honestly, they're very thin skinned, aren't they? Everything's a matter of offense. Everything's a matter of upset. Everything's a matter of, if you ever question anything they say, think, or do, it's never, or very rarely have I heard middle class people go, do you know what? We do that, or even I do that. And that's bad, isn't it? And I shouldn't. I've heard working class people say that. I've heard working class people go, you're right. And we do that. And that's not biblical, is it? We probably need to change there. I haven't heard many middle class people do that. And I think it's just the brittleness. And again, I think it comes back to, I think I mentioned on a previous podcast about judgmentalism. I think there is a baked in judgmentalism to middle class culture, which tells you a bit about how they operate. I think they're very brittle. They're very concerned about their faults being pointed out. And I think part of the reason why is it's because they know they're very quick to look down on other people because it makes them feel good. And I think that's where the class system serves them, because middle class people, by and large, run most of the institutions and the things that we have in this country. They've set up those things to serve people like them. They run by people like them. And anything that questions it questions the power and authority that they have. And when people, I remember reading something John Stevens, who's director of the FIEC, wrote. This was about money. I can't remember what book it was in, but it was, he said something like, I'm sorry if I'm misquoting him, but it's broadly, there are people who have lots of money, but they often don't feel like they've got lots of money. And it's partly because of the circles they move in and the assumptions that they make, and therefore people saying you've got loads of money that you need to give away, you need to be more generous. They feel like they're hard up, even though they're not. And I think it comes to the same with power and authority, where you've got these people with a lot of power and a lot of authority running lots of things, but they don't always feel like they've got lots of power and authority. So when you say, well, here are some people with no power and no authority, and it'd be great if you could just give up a bit to them, give them a seat at the table, give them a voice, give them, a position, that's viewed as, oh, you're asking me to give up stuff, and we're hard done by as well. Do you know what I mean? It's that defensive attitude because they don't actually feel that empowered, even though they often are, and they don't realize it. And it's the nature of privilege, I think. I don't always think that word is used very helpfully. I think, but I do think it's a thing. I don't have a better word. Like, people talk about black privilege, sorry, white privilege. When you're talking about ethnic minority disempowerment and stuff. And again, very often you'll get white people who are very privileged who push back on that and go, oh, you're privileged too. Do you know what I mean? And when you hear what they mean, and I think this is undeniably true, it doesn't matter if you're a black person who's gone to Eton, and gone to Oxbridge and works in a high level job, there are issues you will face because you're black. That I, even though I've never been to Eton and I didn't go to Oxbridge and I don't have a high flying job, because I'm white, I just don't have those issues. That's just a fact. The term privilege often gets misheard because they go, well, what are working class white boys? How are they privileged? But they're not talking about that issue. They're just saying, walking down the street, there are things that you will face as a black person, the white person won't. And that is a matter of privilege. And I think it's the same with class. There are things that middle class people won't have to face that working class people do. And that is a privilege. I don't think the word's always helpful, but if you hear what people mean, it's you won't face things that these people do. But I think people are very quick
Oh, you
to.
have opportunities that these people don't as well, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's not, when you understand what people are saying, I think it's undeniable. And I think it is, it is something that is, it's not a negative thing. It's just a thing, isn't it? I've got privilege in some ways. Everyone has some privilege over other people in some ways. And it doesn't, that's not necessarily a negative or a bad thing. But what it does mean is if you have a particular set of privileges, particularly in a society that's built around giving you those privileges, and someone comes along and says, well, we don't have any of those, is there a way we can, level that up a little bit? You'd hope people would want to hear that and say, yeah, a level of equality of opportunity matters for people, and a level of trying to help people up, particularly when you see systemic issues, like, for example, in the church, where at the end of the day, I just go, you can set aside all the language of class, you can set aside all the language of privilege, all of that stuff, put it to one side. Is there an issue? Is there a demographic of people broadly missing from our churches? And if there is, isn't it valid to say why is that? And isn't it also valid to say what might we do about it? That's where I think we need to have a conversation about class and privilege and that kind of thing that can stop people being quite so brittle and defensive about it.
So I think interesting. I think we'll probably end on this, but I think for me, what you've said there is quite interesting because if we're looking at the working class as being quite a broad sphere of people, I forget, is it precariat, level workers?
Vogue term for a while, yeah.
But yeah, there's so many terms you can use, isn't there, to coin people in. But if we just say under the banner of working class, we're talking about people who were homeless, we're talking about people who were ex-offenders, who were drug addicts, people who were living on the streets, people who have a lovely house and work hard and are educated, either at university or they've got a trade. And some of these working class people are earning twice as much as most middle class people who've got a degree, whether that be because they're in construction or in their own business or whatever. The point being is that I would say that your branch, the church, struggles to reach your branch of working classness more than any other. So what I found is when churches have asked me to go and help with them, reach out to council estates or working class communities, I give what one of the things I do is I'd give them the local government statistics. And say, have a look at the people. What type of people live here? What could we do to reach out to them? And they'll say, oh, we've got 30% single mums. We'll have to do something to help the single mums. Or, oh, 8% of people here are unemployed. We'll do a job club. Or, oh, wow, that's horrendous. 6% are drug addicts. We could do something to help the drug addicts. And I'm like, yeah, but 80% of people aren't drug addicts. And 70% of people aren't single mums, or and 70%. So how are we reaching them? They always seem to focus on the extremes, and those that have. I'm not saying they shouldn't do this, but I'm just thinking the people who are generally missed are the functional, traditional, working class families, and they're never hearing the gospel. And what I found is because of that, the traditional working class families who live near me will come to me when a relative or a friend is a drug addict or struggling financially and say, oh, do you mind I pass your number on to my cousin because they've got this social problem? And I said, your church would be able to help them. And I'm like, yeah, but remember, you need our help just as much because you need Jesus. It's Jesus that we offer. We're not a social service. So fortunately, I've got the relationship where I can like push back and say, look, the church is primarily about Jesus. But it's no surprise that many people think the church is just an extension of social services because the only people that seem to be getting reached are people who are in debt, who have got drugs, who are single parents. And how do you think the church can readdress that problem, start reaching people, obviously from a similar background to you, obviously not raised in the church, but coming from a more traditional working class background?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point because when I say people like me are missing from the church, that's exactly what I mean. Do you know what I mean? I could only think of one other family I grew up in the church who's, and again, the dad ended up working for a Christian organization in the end, but He was a monkman. Do you know what I mean? There was no one else in the church like him. And unsurprisingly, him and my dad became really good mates. Do you know what I mean? Because they were the only two like that. And I think fundamentally the issue is cultural. That's the fundamental issue. Because if you've got your mum and dad at home, which I did, and they're both working, and they're managing, you're doing okay. And my idea of having a decent life, you've got had food on the table most of the time. You had, house over your roof over your head. You went to school, you did your stuff. Your life was kind of normal and okay. You didn't have like any deep-seated or great need. And actually, my dad, I think I told you this story. We used to, when we were in Birkenhead, we went down to this mission. I remember getting a Liverpool football top and being absolutely made up as a kid. Going, I've got a football top. I didn't realise we were the poor family getting the mission clothes, that had been donated. But it didn't bother me. I didn't know, and it was fine. But as we got older, we didn't have needs. Do you know what I mean? We didn't have that sort of social need anymore. We were doing okay, and so a church putting on a lunch for homeless people. Well, we're not going to go to that because we're not homeless, and we don't need drug rehab because we're not on drugs. Do you know what I mean? So none of those things were a problem to us. What was a problem to us was cultural. Again, it's having a wideness to your understanding of what the Bible says that would allow people to talk differently to you and dress differently to you and think differently to you without this immediate reflex of going, this is Christian. And I think this is biblical, and the reason they do that is because everyone who they know who's a Christian thinks those same things because they come from the same culture and they're not very good at getting out of it. And I think it's a problem with, foreign cultures too, people who come from a non-British culture entering into a majority white British church. I think it's difficult for even British non-white people who come from a different ethnic minority background, but they're British born people. They come into majority white churches and find similar problems. And I think it's true for sort of traditional working class people like my family. And I think it's entirely a matter of cultural mindset. And I think a good start would be made by just being less judgmental, by being less quick. If people turn up and present as believers, particularly, I think this is key. I think if someone turns up as a believer, whether they are foreign or ethnic minority or working class, but they present as a believer, rather than jump to why you're doing that, do you know what I mean, as an accusation. When you see them operating differently, even if you think maybe that's unbiblical, perhaps just go and ask them, why they do whatever the thing is. What is it that's, leads to that? And you might just find that they've got a biblical understanding of what they're doing, a biblical framework for what they're doing. And they've just got a different form of that biblical thing to you. And that might help your understanding a little bit on some of those cultural things. I think that would be a pretty minor tweak you could make, that would just help people like me and my family feel a little bit more comfortable in the church and feel a little bit more like people actually want you there and are not saying, because you're different to us, this isn't really for you unless you either become like us or you go. And I think when you read the Bible itself, the number one thing that seemed to hit the churches all the time was cultural. It's constantly this issue between Jews and Gentiles. Did the Gentiles have to act like Jews to be Christians? And the answer all the time was no, they don't need to be like Jews. They can be themselves. And we read it in the Bible and we know it's there in the Bible. I think often that we go, well, we're all Gentiles, aren't we? Without any realization that, I mean, Gentiles is quite a big group of people, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, the Gentiles in Africa weren't quite like the Gentiles in Galatia. They're different people, and they're different cultures. But we've kind of like baptized our culture, and then gone, everyone now needs to do that. And I just think if rather than jump to an assumption that what they're doing is unbiblical, we just ask, well, why do you do that? Why do you think that's okay? Where do you get that from? I think that might be, at least a bit more helpful. Though I think it probably still takes some brave people, do you know what I mean, to venture in and put up with that for a bit and have those sort of things peppered at them for ages. But I mean, I think of our own church, like we had one Iranian guy come, and I think he was pretty brave to come on his own. He was there, only guy. But then because we got that one Iranian, other Iranian guys started to come because they saw someone else who was there like them who said, this is okay. So you need someone to be brave to do it. The same with the Africans. We had one African person come and become a member and stay. And then that led to other Africans coming in. Ah, this is a place for me. It's not just a white person's club. Do you know what I mean? This is for, black people can come here too. And I think it's the same for working class people. If you can just get one working class person to come and stay who can tolerate, the cultural difficulties, you might just get some other working class people who come and go, oh, there is someone else who dresses and talks like me and acts like me, and actually they haven't run a million miles. Maybe this will be okay for me. And I think that's what we need to work hard to get, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I think a good idea for the next podcast might be how do we get those people from the pews to the pulpit? Yeah, because it's great, isn't it? Obviously, we need people to be brave to be there. It's the same with people who turn up at church, isn't it? With two kids and there's no other children, it takes that family to be brave enough to stay and sacrifice to encourage others to come. But we want to see development from that, don't we? We don't just want people coming and making our pulpit, our pews diverse. We want to see our pulpits and leadership diverse too. Awesome. Cheers, brother. Thanks for that. And thanks for joining me on the In Context podcast.
Cheers, mate.